This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Real Piracy in Somalia. A banner headline across the Washington Post front page. Three pirates, three rounds, three dead bodies. A five-day standoff between the Fifth Fleet and a handful of Somali pirates ended on Easter Sunday with the shooting deaths by snipers of three of the Somalis and the release of Captain Richard Phillips of the U.S. flagship Maersk Alabama, a 17,000-ton cargo ship carrying food to East Africa with a crew of 20. A fourth member of the pirate band, who was age 16, and the other Somali pirates had been aged between 16 and 19, had given himself up to the U.S. Navy to get treatment for wounds suffered in an attempt to hijack the American cargo ship. He has been whisked off by the U.S. to places unknown, perhaps one of the secret prisons. His three associates, exhausted and thinking that they were negotiating to secure their own lives in exchange for the release of the captain, had allowed themselves to be attached to the U.S. warship Bainbridge with a tow line, which was then reeled to within 75 feet of the ship. This was a target, a hapless band of Somali hijackers, again, as I mentioned, aged 16 to 19, who had failed in their attempt to seize the American-flagged cargo ship, and then took the ship's captain, Richard Phillips, hostage in their lifeboat. President Barack Obama's decision to assassinate these young pirates took place after he had been briefed 17 times on the situation, and twice provided authorization for the military to kill these young Somalis. What is actually happening across the Horn of Africa? Look at the Wall Street Journal and the rallying it gave towards assassinating the hostages. Obama's next hostage crisis was its headline, April 9, 2009. Unless his administration moves quickly to show that pirates, rogue states, and even a few rogue judges, referring to the judge in Spain who is accusing the prior U.S. administration for its role in torture, will pay a fearsome price for taking U.S. citizens hostages, a similar drama can't be far off. The ship had been bound for Mombasa, Kenya, carrying a cargo of emergency food when it came within 300 miles of Somalia's coastline. But it's the first U.S. flagged vessel to have been hijacked in years, perhaps decades. And the Wall Street Journal goes on. In fact, piracy is making a comeback because the world has largely allowed it. The owners of captured vessels have been willing to pay multi-million-dollar ransoms to recover the ships, 16 of which and 200 crew members are currently in pirate hands. And the Wall Street Journal goes on to say, quote, "We don't advocate reverting to Roman methods, e.g. crucifixion, for dealing with pirates, though the administration could apply the Stephen Decatur standard by bombing the Somali pirate city of Isle. U.S. law is clear that pirates who attack U.S. flagships deserve life in prison. But treating captured pirates as enemy combatants unworthy of Geneva Convention protections would help in cases where pirates attack foreign flagships and international law is now more ambiguous." Look at what the Wall Street Journal is doing, proposing bombing a Somali city, proposing capturing these pirates and holding them as enemy combatants without the rule of law. We need to look at what is actually happening in Somalia, and that is what we will address today on Taking Aim. Ralph?
Not a single individual has been killed by these so-called pirates, not one. There is an article in the London Independent that is worthy of note on January 5th, 2009. The headline is, "You Are Being Lied To About Pirates." It's an instructive piece by Johan Hari. "Who imagined," he writes, "that in 2009, the world's governments would be declaring a new war on pirates? As you read this, the British Royal Navy, backed by ships of 24 nations from the U.S. to China, is sailing into Somalian waters to take on men that we picture as parrot-on-the-shoulder pantomime villains. They will soon be fighting Somalian ships and chasing pirates on the land in one of the most broken countries on earth. But behind the Army Hardy's arty oddness of this tale, there is an untold scandal. The people our governments are labeling as one of the great menaces of our times, quote-unquote, have an extraordinary story to tell, and justice is on their side. Pirates, by the way, have never been quite who we think they are. In the golden age of piracy, from 1650 to 1730, the idea of the pirate as a senseless, savage bluebeard that lingers today was a creation by the British government in a great propaganda undertaking. Many ordinary people believed it was false. Pirates were often saved from the gallows by supportive crowds. Why? What did they see that we don't?" In his book, Villains of All Nations, the historian Marcus Rediker pours through the evidence. "If you became a merchant or a navy sailor, you were plucked from the docks of London's East End, young and hungry, and you ended up in a floating wooden hell. You worked all hours on a cramped, half-starved ship, and if you slacked off, the all-powerful captain whipped you with a cat of nine tails. If you slacked often, you were thrown overboard. At the end of months or years, you were cheated of your wages. Pirates were the first to rebel against this world. They mutinied, and they created a different way of working on the seas. Once they had a ship, the pirates elected their captains, and all decisions were made collectively, without torture. They shared the bounty in what Rediker describes as one of the most egalitarian plans for the disposition of resources to be found anywhere in the 18th century. They took in escaped African slaves, lived with them as equals. The pirates showed quite clearly and subversively," the article continues, "that ships did not have to be run in the brutal, oppressive wars of a merchant service of the Royal Navy," unquote. That is why they were romantic heroes. The words of one pirate from that lost age, a young British man named William Scott, echo into this new age of so-called piracy. Just before he was hanged in Charleston, South Carolina, he said, "What I did was to keep us from perishing. I was forced to go a-pirating in order to survive." In 1991, the government of Somalia collapsed. 9 million people have been teetering on starvation ever since, and the ugliest forces in the Western world have used this as an opportunity to steal the country's entire food supply and dump nuclear waste throughout its coastline. And the article explicitly describes this process. "Yes," it continues, "nuclear waste. As soon as the government had been got rid of by the U.S., mysterious ships started appearing off the coast of Somalia, dumping vast barrels into the ocean shore. The coastal population began to sicken. They suffered strange rashes, nausea, and malformed infants. After the 2005 tsunami, hundreds of dumped leaking barrels washed up on shore, and people began to suffer from radiation sickness. In one location alone, 300 died. Amidou Ould Obada, the UN envoy to Somalia, told me, 'Someone is dumping nuclear material everywhere here. There is lead, heavy metals, cadmium and mercury, you name it. Much of it can be traced to European hospitals and factories who are passing it on to the Italian mafia to dispose of chiefly.' When I asked Mr. Ould Abdallah what European governments were doing about it, he said, 'Nothing. There's no cleanup. There's no compensation. There's no prevention. There's no acknowledgement.' At the same time, other European ships are looting Somalia's seas of their greatest resource, seafood. We have destroyed our own fish stocks by overexploitation. Now the United States and European powers have moved to theirs. Over $300 million worth of tuna, shrimp, and lobster are stolen now each year by these illegal trawlers. The local fishermen are starving. Mohammed Hussein, a fisherman in the town of Marka, told Reuters, 'If nothing is done, there won't be any fish left in our coastal waters.' This is the context in which these so-called pirates emerged. Somali fishermen took speedboats to try to prevent the dumpers and trawlers and levy attacks on them. They called themselves the Volunteer Coast Guard of Somalia, and ordinary Somalis agree. The independent Somali news, Watahir News, found 70% of Somalis' population strongly supported the piracy as a form of national defense, unquote. No, this doesn't make hostage-taking justifiable, and some may be gangsters. But in a telephone interview, one of the pirate leaders said, "We don't consider ourselves to be bandits. We consider the bandits to those who illegally fish and dump toxins in our seas. Do we expect starving Somalis to stand by passively on their beaches paddling in toxic waste, to watch foreign powers snatch their fish to eat in restaurants in London and Paris and Rome? We won't act on these crimes, but when the fishermen respond by disrupting the transit corridor for 20% of the world's oil supply, we send in the gunboats." The story of the 2009 war on piracy was best summarized by another pirate who lived and died in the 4th century B.C. He was captured and brought to Alexander the Great, who demanded to know, quote, what he meant by keeping possession of the sea, unquote. The pirate smiled and responded, "What you mean by seizing the whole earth? Because I do it with a petty ship. I'm called a robber, but you do it with a great fleet, and you're called an emperor." Once again, our great imperial fleet sail. But who is the robber?
This is the article by Johan Hari, "You Are Being Lied To About Pirates," that appeared in The Independent in the United Kingdom Monday, January 5th, 2009. Let's hear from Mark Bowden, the UN resident and humanitarian coordinator for Somalia. August 29, 2008, he was interviewed in Nairobi, and the situation that he describes is even worse today. After almost two decades of civil war and anarchy, Somalia is now suffering one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world, with 3.2 million people, almost half the population, in need of assistance. Access to those in need has become almost impossible, and their food prices are very high. Somalia used to be able to produce its own food and was an exporter of beef and fish. But now Somalia has everything imported, and the food prices are a major problem. He says, "We're looking at groups of people in towns as well as in the countryside that are facing extreme poverty as the result of the food price rises. But that is only the beginning of the story. Because of the million people displaced, some out of the countries and some in internal displacement. Somalia has been disrupted. It is really divided into several areas. The southern part, the northeastern part, Puntland, and the northwest Somaliland. And within this, there is a great deal of instability. Human Rights Watch stated, Somalia is a nation in ruins, mired in one of the world's most brutal armed conflicts. Two long years of escalating bloodshed and destruction have devastated the country's people and laid waste to the capital of Mogadishu. But that is only the beginning of the story, because it is not 2 years. It goes on for decades. Today, the country is one of the three poorest nations on the face of the planet. Over 240,000 Somalis live in squalid conditions in Kenya, in the largest refugee camp in the world. And then 16,000 civilians lost their lives when the U.S.-backed Ethiopian occupation took place, and another 1.2 million people were forced from their homes. After Ethiopia pulled its troops out of Somalia last year, the U.S. installed the Transitional Federal Government, the TFG, a puppet regime of warlords that has since collapsed, and a former leader of the Islamic courts was elected the country's new president by the parliament with the acquiescence of the U.S. government. This is something we're going to discuss later when we discuss the support by the U.S., the propping up of the brutal dictatorship of Siad Barre. But let's now return to the situation of the so-called pirates, which was wonderfully described by Johan Hari in his Independent article. Another article appeared, Radio d'Algiers, and this one by Mohamed Abshir Waldo. The two piracies in Somalia, why the world ignores the other. Ralph?
Yes, Radio d'Algiers published this important article on April 15th, 2009. Much of the world's attention is currently focused on the Somali sea lanes. The navies of big and small powers are converging on the Somali waters in the Gulf of Aden and Indian Ocean. The hijacking of the Saudi oil tanker and Ukrainian MV Fina laden with arms for Kenya off the coast of Somalia captured world media attention. The war has been declared against shipping piracy, but the older and mother of all the piracies in Somalia is the illegal foreign fishing in the Somali seas. It is ignored, underlining the international, quote, community, unquote, misunderstanding and partiality of the interdependent issues and the impracticality of proposed actions to resolve the so-called piracy threat. A chorus of calls for tougher international action has resulted in multinational and unilateral naval stampedes to invade and take control of the Somali territorial and EEZ waters. The United Nations Security Council, a number of whose members have ulterior motives because they are protecting their own illegal fishing fleets in the Somali seas, passed Resolutions 1816 and 1838, providing license to any nation who wants a piece of the Somali marine cake. NATO and the European Union have now issued orders to the same effect. Russia, Japan, India, Malaysia, Egypt, Yemen, and anyone else who can form an armed boat and its crew on the sea for a few months have joined the fray.
Ralph, the UN resolutions 1816 and 1838 refer to the control of piracy and allow the nations of the world to amass a global armada, in effect, an invasion of Somali waters. This is a way, supposedly, of protecting the trade routes off the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean from the Somali piracy. But in fact, it is protecting these illegal fishing trawlers that are robbing Somalia and preventing the Somali fishermen from gaining a living.
Well, first of all, as we will describe here, Somalia, which was food independent and with a productive peasantry, was assailed by the U.S. military, its villages destroyed, its livestock eliminated, and driven into exile in drought conditions, where the starvation was man-made, deliberately provided, and unfurled. That made the Somalia population all more dependent upon the proceeds from the fishing in the waters off the coast of Somalia, which were long a rich resource for fishing for that population. As the article describes, the Somali shipping pirates attract shipping in the sea lane, but that's where the illegal poachers were actively operating. There is another exploiting gang of pirates in Somalia, the article writes. Only one of them gets publicized by the Western media. The other, more powerful and damaging economically, environmentally, and security-wise, is the massive, illegal, organized, state-sponsored foreign fishing piracy that is poaching and destroying the Somali marine sources for 18 years, following the collapse of the Somali regime in 1991, with its usual double standard. When matters concern Africa, the article continues, the, quote, international community, unquote, comes out in force to declare war against Somali fishermen while protecting the illegal, unreported, and unregulated, the IUU, illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing fleets from Europe and the Far East and Arabia and the United States. Biased by UN resolutions, big power orders and news reports condemn hijacking of merchant ships in the Indian Ocean and the Gulf of Aden. But it is in response to the piracy of their waters that these operations have proceeded as a defense mechanism. And the European Union, Russia, Japan, India, even Egypt and Yemen are all on this piracy campaign to cover up and protect their illegal fishing fleets in Somali waters.
An international high seas task force, the HSTF, studied the problem of the invasion of Somali waters. The IUU does not respect national boundaries or sovereignty, puts unsustainable pressure on fishing stocks, marine life, and habitats, undermines labor standards, and distorts markets. Quote, IUU fishing is detrimental to the wider marine ecosystem because it flouts rules designed to protect the marine environment, which includes restrictions to harvest juveniles, closed spawning grounds, and gear modification designed to minimize bycatch on non-target species. In so doing, they steal an invaluable protein source from some of the world's poorest people and ruin the livelihoods of some legitimate fishermen. Incursions by trawlers into the inshore areas reserved for artisanal fishing can result in collision with local fishing boats, destruction of fishing gear, and deaths of fishermen. In its report, Closing the Net, Stopping Illegal Fishing on the High Seas, the HSTF, that is the High Seas Task Force, puts the worldwide value of IUU catches at $4 to $9 billion. $4 to $9 billion. A large part of it comes from sub-Sahara Africa, particularly Somalia. This has a great impact on the local fishermen because laundering through mothership factories, transshipment and resupply at seas, as the report goes on to say, this means that vessels can remain at sea at months, refueling, resupplying, and rotating their crew. The IUU fishing vessels never need to enter ports because they transfer their catches onto transport ships. Illegally caught fish are laundered by mixing with legally caught fish on board transport vessels. This fish laundering generates hundreds of millions of dollars in the black market, and it's not considered criminal as money laundering would be considered criminal. The countries used for the Somali fish laundering include the Seychelles, Mauritius, and the Maldives. And all this is fish that ends up in the European markets. The EU closed much of its fishing waters for 5 to 15 years for fish regeneration, protecting its own fishermen and their fishing stock. In Asia, there's been overfishing seas, so the international demand has increased for the marine products. And as the fishermen are looking for other places to fish, they have invaded the Somali seas and attacked the Somali fishermen who are fishing there. Ralph?
The Somali fishermen are not allowed to resist the organized state pillaging of their coastal waters. For fear of immediately being labeled pirates and attacked by foreign navies, unlawfully control these Somali waters. Even the traditional Somali trading dhows are being called pirates. In other words, any of the fishermen who attempt to fish their own waters are immediately being labeled as pirates by the pirates themselves, the state pirates. The actions of the state piracy, as this article calls it, the notorious shipping piracy, is backed by state power. And the origin of the two piracies goes back to 1992 after the fall of the Siad Barre regime and the disintegration of the Somali Navy and the police Coast Guard services, which was a design of the U.S. invasion. Following the severe droughts in 1974 and 1986, tens of thousands of peasants whose livestock were wiped out were resettled along the villages on the long 3,300-kilometer Somali coast. They developed large fishing communities whose livelihood depend on inshore fishing. From the beginnings of the civil war in Somalia, as early as 1991, these European and U.S. illegal fishing trawlers were trespassing and fishing in Somali waters, including the 12-mile inshore artisanal fishing waters. The piracy between the local fishermen and these IUU started here. Local fishermen have documented trawlers pouring boiling water on fishermen in their canoes, cutting their nets, crushing their small boats, killing all the occupants, the article continues, and numerous abuses suffered by fishermen as they attempted to protect their livelihood and their own national fishing turf. Only later did some fishermen begin to arm themselves in self-defense. Many of the foreign fishing vessels are armed with sophisticated weapons and overpower the fishermen. It was only a matter of time before the local fishermen reviewed their tactics and modernized their warfare. This cycle has been developing since 1991 to the present and has developed into a full-fledged conflict between the indigenous fishermen and the shipping piracy of the state powers of Europe and NATO in particular. According to the High Seas Task Force, there were over 800 illegal fishing vessels in Somali waters at one time, taking advantage of Somalia's inability to control its own waters and fishing grounds. These illegal operations took out more than $450 million in fish value out of Somalia annually, five times the value of anything available to the indigenous fishermen themselves.
Ralph, this extensive article by Mohammed Abshir Waldo is available on the internet at accessoflogic.com, and we'll continue with more information from it because it is an extremely impressive article.
Let me just mention this because, as you say, Maya, the article's of great significance. The author writes the following. The activity that's been described here is nothing other than economic terrorism. Somali fishermen have stated that these poachers not only plunder the fish, but they are dumping toxins and oil into the sea. The government of Somalia is not strong enough to defend the country. We want international agencies to help us deal with this problem, said a representative of the fishermen. If nothing is done, there will be no fish left in our coastal waters, and not merely that. The Mogadishu Maritime and Fisheries Institute has accused the foreign nations and foreign ships of dumping hazardous waste throughout Somali waters. Somali's coastal communities who eke their livelihood from the sea are appealing to the international community for help to stop the NATO and European powers and the U.S. from the developed countries that are robbing our marine wealth and destroying our habitat.
Well, let's return to the piracy. The illegal fishing trawlers, these foreign fishing trawlers, have been actually specified. And in this article, he cites fishing companies from Italy, France, Spain, Greece, Russia, Britain, Ukraine, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, India, Yemen, Egypt, as well as others. And some of these vessels were captured off the Somali coast by Somali fishermen between 1991 and 1999. And these included Taiwanese trawlers, the Yefa No. 3, the Qianyuan No. 232, the FV Xuanquo No. 11, the MV Aeron, the MV Giosa Giuseppe, the MV Antonietta, all three Italian vessels registered in Italy. The MV Bahari Hindi, Kenyan registered but owned and managed by Marship Company of Mombasa. A number of Italian registered SHIFCO vessels, Korean and Ukrainian trawlers, Indian, Egyptian, and Yemeni boats were also captured by fishermen and ransoms of different sizes paid for their release. Many Spanish seiners, you know, the big net boats, frequent violators of the Somali fishing grounds, managed to evade capture at various times, but the fishermen did cite them. It's not just the foreign companies coming in. They do it in collaboration with the Somali warlords. New companies were formed abroad for and provided bogus licenses to these foreign companies. Jointly owned mafia Somali European companies set up in Europe and Arabia worked closely with the Somali warlords and issued these licenses. UK and Italy-based African and Middle East trading company, the AFMET, Palmera, and UAE-based Samico companies were some of the corrupt vehicles issuing these counterfeit licenses. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Real Piracy in Somalia. Ralph?
Dr. Mustafa Tolba, the executive director of UNEP, has confirmed that Italian companies are dumping lethal toxic waste throughout Somalian waters, contributing, quote, to the loss of life in an already devastated country. Dr. Tober added that the shipment of these toxic wastes from Italy aggravates the total destruction of the ecosystem in Somalia and earns a company which ships the waste between $2 to $3 million in profits per shipment. It's instructive to note that this is an operation in Italy that is in conjunction with the mafia, because the mafia has been subcontracted to organize the dumping of nuclear and radioactive and toxic waste in conjunction with the pillaging of the resources, the fishing resources of the area. As the article continues, this global armada is in Somali waters illegally. It is not approved by the Somali Transitional Federal Republic. It is, in fact, in defiance of the will of the Somali population. At a press conference in Nairobi on October 18, 2008, the Deputy Speaker of the Parliament, Mohamed Omar Dalla, termed the deployment of foreign warships to the country's coast as invasion of its sovereignty and asked these warships to move out of our waters. The Speaker questioned the intent of the deployment and stated that the powers have a hidden agenda. Their hidden agenda is to pillage our fishing and to dump on our shores. The millions of dollars given to pirates or wasted in warship policing were in fact a cover for a European Union and NATO operation against our country. It is morally wrong. It has no international basis, the statement continues, and it is quite clear what is happening here. Quote, nobody gives a damn about the people in Somalia. We are dying like flies. This was the conclusion as well of the European Union Observer on October 15, 2008. As the article concludes, the European Union, NATO, and the U.S. navies can, of course, Rambo-like obliterate the fishermen and their supporting coastal communities. This is an illegal and criminal act. And indeed it is. It is the essence of imperialism. It is a replay of the whole colonial process of the 18th and 19th century with all of the ruthless power of the imperial era in our own time.
Ralph, I'd like to go into a little more detail about the toxic dumping. You came across an important article that actually had appeared in the Voice of America. Waste dumping off Somali coast may have links to mafia, Somali warlords, by Alicia Ryu, coming out of Nairobi, March 15th, 2005. There had been journalists who had been studying it, but it came out wider in the press after the tsunami of 2004, after it had hit the coast of Somalia in late December, and it did more than level villages and kill hundreds of people. It also churned up a secret, writes Ryu, that some must have hoped would remain forever buried at sea. Nick Nuttall of the UN Environment Program in Nairobi explained that as the wave receded, residents living along Somalia's northern coast noticed dozens of rusting steel drums, barrels, and other containers deposited on their beaches. Quote, Somalia has been used as a dumping ground for hazardous waste starting about the early 1990s and continuing through the Civil War. European companies found it to be very cheap to get rid of waste there, costing as little as $2.50 a ton, where disposal costs in Europe are something like $250 a ton. And the waste is many different kinds: uranium, radioactive waste, lead, heavy metals like cadmium and mercury, industrial waste, hospital waste, chemical waste, you name it, said Mr. Nuttall. Warnings about a potential health and environmental disaster from the illegal waste dumping began as early as 1992, a year after the Somali warlords overthrew the government of dictator Mohamed Siad Barre, the U.S. propped-up dictator. At the time, the UNEP official in Nairobi, Mustafa Kamal Tolba, told reporters that he was convinced that there was European firms dumping the hazardous waste, but nobody did anything about it. Ralph?
Maya, the containers that came ashore caused countless numbers of local people to fall ill, suffering from mouth and abdominal bleeding and skin infections and other ailments. What's important here is the following. This, again, is the Voice of America, and it's remarkable that on such an outlet we have this information. Amina Mohammed, told The Voice of America that an Italian television journalist named Ilaria Alpi, who took up the investigation. In 1994, Ms. Alpi and her cameraman were killed traveling in Somalia. Ms. Mohammed stated the journalist was assassinated. She was killed because there were many things that she discovered. There are Italian companies, there's the mafia, there's the whole range of people and dealers and brokers involved in this task. The journalist had been investigating the allegations that the mafia-run companies in Italy were regularly transporting industrial waste to Somalia for dumping. The organized crime group controlled 30% of Italy's waste disposal companies and was working in full conjunction with the authorities.
And the Somali warlords.
Ms. Alpi discovered that much of the waste was being carried from Italy to its former colony aboard fishing vessels belonging to a company that called itself the Somali High Sea Fishing Company. So they're not only going and pirating the fish, but they're utilizing a so-called fishing fleet to facilitate the dumping of nuclear and toxic waste on a systematic basis.
And the investigation goes deeper between the collaboration of the Somali warlord government and the Italian mafia. Ralph?
This is a process that has its roots in the nature of imperialism.
Yes, Ralph. I was about to say that she stated, the company was owned by the Somali government and is in the hands of a manager who is a member of the Somali parliament. Ralph?
Asmaya, we have addressed here the nature of the real piracy in the Somali waters and the link between the looting of the fishing resource of this population, leaving aside the issue of the harm to the ecolife and the fish themselves, which is another subject. But it is the issue concerning the survival of a people under siege by imperialism. On January 18, 1993, an important article appeared in the Los Angeles Times by Mark Feynman, who is one of the few mainstream reporters who has been in the had been consistently exposing the nature of imperial conquest, whether it was in Iraq or in other parts of the Arab East. And here Mark Feynman writes, "The oil factor in Somalia. Four American petroleum giants had agreements with the African nation before the Civil War began and will reap big rewards. Far beneath the surface of the tragic drama of Somalia," he writes, "four major U.S. oil companies are sitting on a prospective fortune in exclusive concessions to exploit tens of millions of acres of the Somali countryside. That land, in the opinion of their geologists, will yield significant amount of oil and natural gas if the U.S.-led mission can establish itself in the impoverished East African nation. According to documents," he writes, "obtained by the Los Angeles Times, two-thirds of Somalia has been allocated to the American oil giants Conoco, Amoco, Chevron, and Phillips in the final years before Somalia's U.S. president government Siad Barre was overthrown. It is, brothers and sisters, with the overthrow of the U.S. puppet Mohammed Siad Barre that the process of destroying Somalia unfolds. The companies holding these most promising concessions were relying on the Bush administration to send U.S. troops to safeguard shipments to Somalia and to protect the multimillion-dollar oil investments there." The article states, "The administration and State Department claimed that the U.S. military mission was strictly humanitarian. Oil industry spokesmen were quick to dismiss as absurd and nonsense the allegations by aid experts and veteran East Africa analysts and prominent Somalis that President Bush, the former Texas oil man, was moving into Somalia on behalf of the U.S. corporate oil stake. But corporate and scientific documents disclose that the American companies were well positioned to pursue Somalia's promising oil potential reserves the moment the nation was, quote, pacified, unquote. And the State Department and U.S. military officials," Mark Feynman continues in the Los Angeles Times, "acknowledge that these oil companies have done more than simply sit back and hope. Conoco, Inc., the major multinational corporation that maintains a functioning office in Mogadishu throughout the past 2 years of nationwide anarchy, is directly involved in the U.S. government's role in the military effort. Conoco, whose tireless exploration efforts in north-central Somalia yielded the most encouraging oil prospects just before Siad Barre's fall, permitted the Mogadishu corporate compound to be transformed into the de facto American embassy a few days before the U.S. Marines landed in the capital, with Bush's special envoy using Conoco as his temporary headquarters. In addition, the president of the company's subsidiary in Somalia won official praise as the government's facilitator during the months before and during the U.S. intervention. Describing the arrangement as a, quote, business relationship, an official spokesman for the Houston-based parent corporation of Conoco Somalia Limited stated, the U.S. government was paying rental for its use of the compound as an embassy, and insisted that Conoco was proud of resident general manager Raymond Marchand's contribution to the U.S.-led invasion. John Gebauer, spokesman for Conoco Oil in Houston, said, the company was acting as a good corporate citizen and neighbor in granting the U.S. government's requests to use the compound. The U.S. Embassy and other buildings and residential compounds in the capital had been subject to vandalism by the population, the starved population of Somalia, in their hatred for the United States intervention. In its House to House magazine, Conoco reprinted excerpts from a letter of commendation written by U.S. Marine Brigadier General Frank Labuti, acting as the military aide to the U.S. envoy, Robert B. Oakley. In the letter, Labuti praised oil officials for their role in the operation to land Marines on Mogadishu's beaches in December, and the general concluded, without Conoco's courageous contributions and selfless service, our military operation would have failed, unquote. But the close relationship, Mark Feynman writes, between Conoco and the U.S. intervention forces has left Somalis and development experts deeply troubled by the blurred lines between the U.S. government and the large oil corporations that lead many to liken the Somali operation to a miniature version of Operation Desert Storm, the U.S.-led military effort to drive Iraq from Kuwait and to secure the world's largest oil reserves, Mark Feynman writes. They sent all the wrong signals when Oakley moved into the Conoco compound, said an expert on Somalia who worked with one of the four major companies as they intensified their exploration efforts in the late 1980s. It's left everyone thinking the big question here. This isn't famine relief. This is oil concessions. It's worth billions of dollars, and that's what the whole game looks like, quote unquote. Yes, the article states, the declared mission to feed Somalia's starving masses is really reduced to the question, how much oil in Somalia can we obtain? There's no doubt that that oil is here, said Thomas O'Connor, the principal petroleum engineer for the World Bank, who headed an in-depth three-year study of oil prospects in the Gulf of Aden off of Somalia's northern coast. You don't know until you study a lot further how much is really there. It has huge potential. Brothers and sisters, the Mark Feynman article is unmistakable in its thrust and in its import. Beginning in 1986, Conoco and Amoco and Chevron and Phillips and Shell obtained the exploration license for northern Somalia from Siad Barre's government. Somalia was carved up into concessional blocks, with Conoco, Amoco, and Chevron winning the right to exploit the most promising ones. The company's interest in Somalia predated the World Bank study and was grounded in the findings of another highly successful exploration effort by Texas-based Hunt Oil Corporation across the Gulf of Aden in the Arabian Peninsula nation of Yemen, where geologists disclosed in the mid-1980s that the estimated 1 billion barrels of oil reserves were part of a great underground rift that arced into and across northern Somalia. In fact, Hunt's Yemeni operations were yielding 200,000 barrels of oil a day, implications for the entire region not lost on then-Vice President George Bush. Bush witnessed it firsthand in April 8, 1986, when he officially dedicated Hunt's new $18 million refinery. In remarks during the event, Bush emphasized the critical value of supporting U.S. corporate efforts to safeguard oil reserves in the region. Quote, the growing strategic importance to the West of crude oil sources in this region are decisive for us, Bush was quoted in the authoritative Middle East Economic Survey. I want to just mention, brothers and sisters, that Mark Fineman, who had been so courageous and extraordinary investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times, was found dead at the age of 51 in Baghdad. Maya?
The rationale for the U.S. invasion in 1992, hiding the fact that there was the interest in oil and the takeover of Somalia, was that this was an act of humanitarian intervention. At the time, after the great drought, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta revealed in December 1992 that 70% of Somali children under five had died within the previous 6 months. And that's when President George Bush, the father of the past President Bush, declared that the dispatch of thousands of U.S. troops to Somalia was, quote, God's work, designed to, quote, save the Somali people from starvation. And at the time, Ralph, you wrote a series of articles that became a pamphlet, The Real Meaning of the U.S. Invasion of Somalia, that showed that this was not humanitarian intervention, and in fact that the role of the United Nations was to disrupt the Somali situation and to prevent the people of Somalia from feeding and clothing themselves. What the UN did was send 29,000 personnel from around the world, and they were brought to Somalia under United Nations cover. The corporate contractors, whose costs were subsidized by the UN funds, made even more money by selling luxury services at exorbitant costs and importing food, and including fish and beef, which were available in Somalia, from contractors in New Zealand, the Netherlands, and Kenya. The beef was secured at high prices in Australia and dispatched in specifically chartered ships, again at exorbitant costs. The role of the United Nations at that time, as it is today, was not to restore the Somali economy, but to prevent Somalia from ever again becoming self-sufficient in food production or enable it to engage in the export of agricultural production and livestock. And what we've seen develop since 1992 is the further destruction of Somalia, leading to the rape of the Somali seas and the inability of the fishermen to at all gain a livelihood. Ralph.
I wrote in 1992 the following, The Siad Barre Regime and U.S.-backed Slaughter. Writing in the Boston Globe on December 1st, 1992, Alan Lobel described, quote, what is truly a new world disorder, unquote, where starvation, quote, unquote, provides the opportunity for immediate solutions which rest not on complicated questions of trade surpluses or debt repayment, but on the ability of the world's most expensive military to scare the crapola out of so-called bandits, unquote. The Orlando Sentinel cautioned, quote, the chaos the world sees today in Somalia is really the result of a specific cause, a civil war triggered when there was a split between the rebels who ousted the East African nation's president in 1991, unquote. What really happened in Somalia? Unified as Somalia in June 1960 after northern British Somaliland and the southern territory administered by Italy won power, General Mohamed Siad Barre seized power in a 1969 coup. He had been armed by the United States, South Africa, and Israel, but turned suddenly to Soviet arms until Soviet leaders switched support to Ethiopia, whose Ogaden region had a Somali population in history. U.S. rulers then proceeded to establish a major military staging post and port facility astride the Horn of Africa. In 1977, on the eve of the Camp David Accords, the Carter administration began a full military operation supporting the Siad Barre regime and signed a $100 million agreement for the port of Berbera. By 1985, $600 million had been given to Siad Barre, which was used for his family, clan, and armed bands. The newly formed Rapid Deployment Forces held joint military exercises with Siad Barre's military in 1983, until the United States shifted the headquarters of the U.S. Central Command for Barbara to Florida, the staging ground from which a main component of the 28,000 U.S. invasion force was dispatched to Mogadishu. Under U.S. tutelage, the Siad Barre regime murdered over 150,000 Somalis who did not submit to his rule. These deaths occurred, for the large part, within a short distance of the United States base in Berbera, whose forces provided backup for the Siad Barre organized slaughter. A report by a consultant to the State Department documented, quote, widespread, systematic, and extreme violent assault upon the unarmed civilian Isak population in northern Somalia. Jane Berlez in the New York Times on September 24, 1992, wrote, quote, the brutalities took place even though there was no danger to Somali armed forces. The army made systematic attacks against villages, watering points, and grazing areas, conducting roundup, summary executions, and massacres of the unarmed civilian population. Quote, continuing, civilian detainees of the government were subject to severe beatings, stabbing, prolonged choking, the use of metal clips and electric shock on flesh and testicles, and immersion in excrement, unquote. Her account in the New York Times details the slaughter of the people in the capital, Mogadishu, upon the jailing of four Islamic leaders who protested against this brutal U.S.-sponsored repression. By the end of 1990, despite U.S. and South African military aid, Siad Barre fled to the bush. His former supporters, Ali Mahdi Mohammed and Mohammed Farah Aidid, fought for control. Cast now as warlords, they were in fact the pillars of the regime that had enjoyed U.S. support. In October 1992, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation reported what it labeled, quote, the U.S.-run rat line for war criminals of the Siad Barre regime. Washington has quietly allowed them into the United States on tourist visas and facilitated their passage into Canada. Ali Mohammed Siad, the eldest son of Siad Barre and a colonel in the army responsible for torture and slaughter, is living in luxury in Vancouver, unquote. Another of those who the United States quietly brought to North America was Colonel Yusuf Abdi Ali Toka, one of 300 Somali officers trained in the mid-1980s at Fort Leavenworth. In spring 1998, this U.S. Special Force protege executed 120 civilians in the northern village of Gabilal. The officers and intelligence operatives trained by the United States to sustain Siad Barre in power were directed by the U.S. Ambassador to Somalia, James Bishop. Pressed about the crimes of those for whom he arranged escape to the United States, he replied, I never saw anyone in the embassy with actual blood on their hands. Bishop is the top administrator of the State Department's, quote, Bureau on Human Rights. Somalia's starving and dying villages were driven from their areas and homes by U.S. forces. Their food stocks and reserves were stolen, their livestock was confiscated, their villages were burnt in a scorched earth policy which lasted years. Quote, as the internecine slaughter and strife depopulated Somalia's farms, its population of refugees and the displaced swelled to more than 1 million people. They collected in towns and makeshift camps and overcame whatever supplies of sanitation may have existed, unquote. The roots of the devastation in Somalia, the roots of the resistance of the Somali fishermen, the roots of the resistance to the organized piracy of their seas and the dumping of toxic waste lies in the oil-driven, rapacious imperial conquest of this the most impoverished and desperate people.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Real Piracy in Somalia, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. Please contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net. We'll be with you next week. Tatam ta chinda ta ro tatam ta silon dok.